Hi, everyone. My name is Ralph, and I am an alcoholic. My sobriety date is September 1st, 1956. My home group is the Empire Way Group in Seattle, Washington. Thank you. Nice to have all my friends here, or both of them.
Well,
our panel today is 12-stepping the old-fashioned way. I had a significant birthday a little over 3 years ago. And I sort of reconstructed conservatively. At that point, conservatively, I had heard 25,000 AA talks. There was 12 good ones. I gave 7 of those.
Yeah.
Hey, well. I was kidding. Talking is what we are known for, but 12-stepping is how it works. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we try to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Before I introduce our first speaker, there's a couple of announcements I've been asked to make. First, to ask for a moment of silence and gratitude for the AA recoveries of the past 75 years. Before I introduce our first speaker, I would go back just a few years past our birthday, when Roland H. was talking to Carl Jung in Vienna, and then he had the problem, his alcoholism, solved, and he went back on his way to the United States. He stopped in Paris to visit with old friends, and they toasted him with wine, and he shared some of the wine, and he was off and running again. And he went back, talked to Dr. Jung, and Dr. Jung said, with alcoholics of your advanced state, without a spiritual experience, without some spiritual help, there's little help for you. And he worked with him, and he got him now sober again. And based on that thought about the spiritual approach, he got involved with the Oxford group. And the Oxford group, of course, that was the precursor for the 12th step, because they used a different word we can't use here, but to go out and talk to another alcoholic. And he went out, Roland H. went out and talked to Ebby T., told and talked to him about his recovery as it was and the help from the Oxford groups. And Ebby T. then had to find somebody to 12th step when we stopped to think about it. And he found Bill W. Bill W., when he was in extremis down in Akron, Mayflower Hotel, that afternoon, he had to find another alcoholic. And, of course, you know the rest of the story. He talked to Dr. Walter Tunks, who suggested Henrietta Seiberling. But that was the seed of what became the 12th step. And I'd like to introduce as our first speaker this afternoon from Oklahoma, Chuck B. I said, what can I say? He says, I still have the passion for one-on-one service. From Oklahoma, Chuck B.
My name is Chuck, and I'm an alcoholic. My home group is the New Haven group in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Those five members are all Baptist and in the back. You may have been rained on. You may have got drenched in sweat. You may have been lost and went the wrong way, and you may be totally devastated. Do not be discouraged. We're going to 12-step you the old-fashioned way here this next hour. I did the same quick review of history. I did a quick one. I think he did a long one. And the events that, the thing that stood out to me in those events, Roland calling on Abby, Abby calling on Bill, Bill calling on Bob. It was always the guy trying to stay sober that took the action. That seems significant to me, and that just stands out to me. So we will start there. One other little piece of history. In Bill's first 6 months, he called on drunks around New York, moved them in the house with him ad infinitum. And at the end of a few months, he was totally frustrated, and and he said to Lois, "I worked so hard and not one of them are sober." And Lois said, "You are." So again, maybe the very guts of our AA program. So, old-fashioned 12-stepping begins with the one already sober calling on the one not yet sober. And now to my personal experience. It's not all, I didn't do all research. I'm going to share some experience with you. I retired the first time in 1998. I know you think I was too young, and you're right, I was. I happened to live close to a park that has a mile track. And so I could walk in the middle of the morning, and sometime in the spring of 1998, I was walking that mile track, and about halfway through, I noticed a guy sitting at one of the picnic tables drinking Listerine or some mouthwash. And I thought, I bet he's not having too good a day. I also thought, if he's still here this next lap, I'll go talk to him. And I thought he'd be gone, frankly. But he was. He was still there the next lap. So I sat down. I'm not a salesman type. I don't just start conversations, frankly. Most people really talk longer than I want to listen. I sat down and I said, my best guess is you're not having the best day you've ever had. And he said, well, no, it's not so good today. And I said, I don't want to waste any words. I see you're drinking out of the Listerine bottle. I'm a recovered drunk. And if you're drinking Listerine, that tells me I need to be further back, closer. Good, I don't want you to miss a word. I said, you drinking Listerine tells me that you're probably in trouble. He said, oh, yeah. I said, I've been thinking I might do something for a long time. He said, I walked to Muskogee one time, and I was going to check in the VA, which is about 45 or 50 miles. He said, I walked the whole way. He said, I've got my number here, and if I'll go to the VA, they'll help me. And I said, well, there's no time like today. I've got my cell phone here. And I said, let's call them. So I looked up the number, and I dialed the number, and he got somebody, and he'd give them this magic number, and they said, yes, come on down. We'll help you. So I load him in the car. And it's interesting. We're on the way down on an expressway, and he looks over there, and he said, you know, I could be working over there for $8 an hour, but I'd have to do it through one of these employment deals, and they'd get $4 an hour out of me, and I'm not going to do it. And I thought, I don't believe he's reached ego deflation at death yet. I said, my God, man, you're drinking Listerine? You could be drinking work for $8 an hour. That's just a little sidelight that's always stuck out to me. So I get him to the VA center, and sure enough, they take him in a room there, but I coached him a little. I stopped and got him some cigarettes, and he had $3 or $4 that he'd found, he said. And so I said, now, when you get in there, I said, if they go to acting like they're going to push you out, I said, you just go into DTs early. He just looked at me and grinned because he knew what I was talking about. The only reason that I knew to tell him that is my sponsor told me. And I got sober in 1976. You can calculate after the meeting. I'm the young guy, I think, up here. There wasn't even a treatment center in Tulsa, Oklahoma in 1976. And so if you could get them to the hospital and get them in a room, you just run off and left them so they couldn't send them back home with you. So that's old-fashioned. That's 12-step calling the old-fashioned way. Of course, I give him my name and phone number because I could just see him 10 years later giving my name from the podium. No ego involved in that 12-step. I never heard from him again. My sponsor said, to remind you all, he said, if they give you a standing ovation, it'll be because you quit talking, not because of what you said. Let's go to 2008, 10 more years. I made one or two 12-step calls between 1998 and 2008, but I can't tell you about all of them. So let's go to 2008. I want to tell you about George. That could be any George, by the way. None of you Georges here, I'm pretty sure. George's wife had called our central office, and our central office called me and said, George's wife called, and we can't get anybody to call her back because George won't call. And I've got a reputation. I said, sure, I'll call her. Give me her number. So I called George's wife, and she said, now, I swear to you, George would call, but he's too sick. That's the truth. I said, ma'am, it's all right. You could be lying, and I'd come anyway if George would listen to me. So George's wife, well, I called George's wife, and then I called Mike, and Mike and I went to see George. I swear to God, I was sure we were going to have a second picture of the man on the bed. George was, he was on the bed. He was in his PJs. He had there his pot to pee in. He had there his jug to puke in. He had there his jug to drink out of. And he had there his jug to chase it with. I don't think he was bothering that one much. And George was that sick. And, you know, he was praying to anybody that had listened to him. And he said, I'll do anything. It was strange to me. George was not blacked out. He had a memory good. George had been sober 15 years once in Tulsa, Oklahoma. I knew his sponsor. And he told me why he got drunk. George got drunk from a resentment. And we talked to George a little bit, and he really was in bad shape. And so finally Mike and I split rooms, and I told his wife, I said, you better call somebody and get him in the hospital. He's going to die. So she got her son on the phone, and I got on the phone with him, and he said, I just told him if he keeps on, he's going to die in 2 or 3 years. I said, my God, man, 2 or 3 years, he's going to die in 2 or 3 days. George went to the hospital. They got George dried out, and they got George home. I stayed in touch with him. He got to feeling a little better, and he had time to do everything but go to AA. And so that's the end of that story, but Chuck stayed sober. And also, the thing that stays with me about that story that I remember, and Bill writes about it in the book, Resentment's the Number One Offender, George had literally got drunk because he didn't get to talk on the night they promised he'd get to talk. And the bad part of that is, you know, we think maybe I'll get back, but there's never a guarantee that we get back. But as I say it, that's old-fashioned 12-step calling. The 12-step call the old-fashioned way. Let's go to 2009, and I want to talk about Calico. I just made that name up. A lady about my age in my group, she thinks I'm safe by then. She said, you know, Calico's back out there again. And she remembers that you was nice to her. And so I'd call Calico occasionally. Sometimes she'd take the call, sometimes she wouldn't. But in about March 2009, another lady about my age that also thinks I'm safe. My wife thinks that too, by the way. Said Calico would like to hear from you, and I said, okay. So I called her, and she needed a ride to somewhere. You know, it's never I need help or I'm in trouble with my drinking. I go, and she's down to chocolate chips for her food array. And that had been the last 2 days she's eaten chocolate chips. And so, you know, she ate three burritos quicker than anybody I ever seen, I'll tell you that. We got her started. Has been easy for her, wasn't easy for her, but she's here today. So we'll leave Calico anonymous. Also in 2009's a big year for me. July this month, matter of fact, 2009. There was a guy right out of prison. He come to my home group on a Friday night. We have a speaker meeting. So, you know, everybody comes dressed in their semi-best. And he had approached the youngest, best-looking woman there he could find, looking for a sponsor. He was only about 30 years older than her, but she had been well sponsored, and she brought him to me. Said that James needs a sponsor. Well, I was certain I wasn't looking for James. I wasn't looking for anybody else to sponsor. Frankly, I was wanting to go home and watch whatever show I had recorded, to tell you the truth about it. But I began to talk to James a little bit. And I said, well, we'll hire me temporarily, and, you know, let's meet. Let's talk about it. Let's see. I was certain, you know, that God brought James to me, just absolutely certain. And he was reasonably smooth. And so my wife, by the way, is very private, very conservative, good member of Al-Anon. Within 2 or 3 weeks, she likes me too, by the way. My wife, I'm talking about. Within 2 or 3 weeks, we were both convinced that James needed to come to our house. They wasn't treating him right out there. So we moved James in and kept him 6 months. I had as good a success as Bill did. What I learned from that was, I've already known this, I've told people for years, you know, you can't put too much weight on one relationship. Your boss, your best friend, can't be your sponsor. It won't work out. Same way with your wife or husband, by the way. Well, if it's working for you, go for it. My experience has been it has not worked out for those people I have worked with. Let's go there. So what happened was I was James's financial advisor. I was his work advisor. That means I got him there on time. I made the lunches. And a lot of other advisor. But he did not want me to sponsor him. He told me once, he said, if it had been anybody else but you, I'd have stabbed you. And I said, I'm not really that tough. You're here because my wife and I believe that you're supposed to be here, and I'm here. You're here on my faith, not on my toughness. But at any rate, that's what I learned from that old-fashioned 12-step call. I stayed sober. But I had another one just a few weeks later. Just what I wanted you to say. Because I'm on my last. My stepson likes women. He's a doctor and good looking, and so he's got three wives. I mean, not all at the same time, but my wife being a good Al-Anon, why, that second wife's got some children by him, and so she never did quit being the daughter-in-law, even though we've got an additional one now. A little side, like, I was sponsoring this guy in Al-Anon one time, and his wife kept having trouble at work. She was pretty, he thought, and that man kept hitting on her. And I said, dude, I've got two good-looking daughter-in-laws, and they both work in the public. And they're not having the same trouble your wife's having. She needs to look at her. That's just a sidelight. That ain't got nothing to do with nothing about 12-step working. But this daughter-in-law with these two grandkids that are 14 and 12, I may have left this one out. May have should have. I'm gonna get through it. Where'd my water jug? Never mind. There's a 14-year-old kid, and he come to me and said, "Mama's in bad shape." So I give him a script. So what I said, "Tell Mama this." He said, "Poppy, that ain't gonna work." He said, "I don't even want you to tell her that I came to you and said anything." And I said, "Okay, I'll go." And I said, "Don't worry, I won't tell on you. I'm an experienced liar. That'll be easy to take care of." So I call on our grandchildren's mother. And I went and talked to, I need another name, Pauline, Henrietta Pauline. I went and talked to Henrietta Pauline about my drinking. And I said, you know about the family that you're still kind of a piece of. And I said, word travels fast. You know, so I know what's going on with you. I understand. I think you're a trooper. You're still working. You're a trooper, but there's a better way. There's a better way. And I give her the book. You know, I tell her, I've been sober a long time, always in the same place, been in service structure. And that's a lot of stuff to tell you. And a lot of people know me in Tulsa, Oklahoma. I said, if you go to a meeting and, you know, we're together, why, you're going to get more attention than you want. I promise you that. I said, here's a meeting book. There's a meeting right down the road. I trust the AA process. I told her to go to the meeting down the road. She went to the meeting down the road. She got sober. She's going to have a year. So, old-fashioned 12-stepping. Now we really got to talk fast. All right. Here's my rules. I need to find a prospect. I need to see them go where they are. I'm not there to save their soul. I'm not even there to diagnose them. I'm just there to share my experience. I need to get them to a meeting and trust the AA process. I, as well as you know, there's a lot of criticism about how the unidentified A is not doing it right, doing too much of it ad infinitum. I believe there's a lot of old-fashioned 12-stepping still happened. If drug court comes to you and you don't do an old-fashioned 12-step call, shame on you. If they bus them to you in a whole bus and you don't get one of them aside and do an old-fashioned 12-step call, shame on you. But if you're in the group that's not doing it right, I would suggest this. We've got a slogan for that. We've got a slogan for everything. Let it begin with me. Thank you.
I'm going to try to move this microphone just away a little bit away so I can get the feedback on that, and maybe we could get Bob out here to sort of monitor how that's coming across for me. And next from Florida, I'd like to introduce Virginia. I asked to tell me about just a little bit about yourself, and she says she's developed the ability to adjust to new people. From Florida, Virginia.
My God, what an awesome crowd. I am Virginia, a grateful recovering alcoholic. And I don't share my sobriety because I don't think you'll remember it anyhow. But it is April in 1966 I came to recovery, more dead than alive. And I am in an awesome space to realize how much God has blessed Alcoholic Anonymous. When I look at this crowd, it's an amazing thing to know that we are addicted to alcohol and all other mind-altering drugs, in case you get confused. But what a powerful spiritual blessing it is to be a part of this international. I was getting real emotional while I'm sitting there. You know,
this
ought to
help.
And I said, "Girl, you better be still. I got some sponsors sitting out there watching me." In fact, I have an original sponsor that is a direct result of me being trained in Alcoholic Anonymous on 12-step work. The good old back-to-basic days when I came in, you made a call, and you got a chance to hide behind the phone before you had to face the person individually. "I'm having trouble. I'm drinking too much. And I can't stop." And they would send someone to pick you up. Well, a dainty little lady came to pick me up. First, she sent a big bully who paved the way. And she put me in a very peaceful zone because she told me she had lived like I was living. She had drank like I was drinking. She almost died like I was trying to die. And she sent a very dainty, soft-spoken, quiet lady to call on me. And I thought, well, this will be a breeze, you know. I won't really have a hard time with this one, because she was so soft and easy. "Darling," you know, when I went to say a dirty word, she said, "Darling, we don't talk like that anymore. We are ladies." I said, "You be a lady, I'll be what I want to be." But nevertheless, I really look back and I see giants whose shoulders that I stand on, because they would hang around the clubhouse. And they were retired people, and they would hang around the clubhouse, and they would fight over who gets the next 12-step call. "Well, you got the one yesterday." "No, I didn't. That was Sarah." You know, but there was a little disturbance, and she won the opportunity to come and call on me. I was not too impressed because she had a new late model car. She was soft and easy. But she never let me have any money. And I never got a chance to ask her for any. But my impressions built up rather rapidly compared to the doubt and fears that I was living with. They used to allow you to come to the clubhouse every day and clean the bathrooms and wash the white cups so that they would stay white, soak them and clean up the place. You know, I didn't clean up my own house, but I went down and cleaned the clubhouse. You had an opportunity to share in answering calls and answering the phones and doing little duties around. And I'm saying all this because I see so much of the basics slipping. I see so much of go to the meeting closest to your house, you know, or I'll pick you up a couple of times. And I'm seeing some great work done, but I'm seeing, I almost reached that stage where I thought, I'm getting older now, so it's time for me to kind of semi-retire. Well, when you retire, it's when they put you 6 feet under the ground when you're a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, as far as I'm concerned today. I think we're getting so relaxed that the message is not clear. And people really think, you know, can you let me have a couple of dollars for bus fare? Can you do this? What can you do for me? And I was told way back in the day that my assignment was to become a part of the cure, to make it a better place and to make things more palatable for the newcomers to understand that this is not just a trip to the Dairy Mart to get an ice cream cone. This is a way to live so that you can benefit and be here to give the message of recovery to someone else. So I got indoctrinated real early, and they refused to allow me to be lazy mentally, physically, or spiritually, you know, because it was clear to me when they said most of us are unwilling to admit we're real alcoholics, so it is not surprising that our drinking career is characterized by countless vain attempts to prove that we could drink, be, and do like other people. The idea that somehow, someday, we can drink, control, and enjoy our drinking is a great obsession of every abnormal drinker. Many pursue it into the gates of insanity or death. We learn, and I learn, that I had to fully concede to my innermost self that I am truly an alcoholic. This is the first step in recovery, not step one. This is the first step in recovery. And when I conceded that I had used up all the chips, that I was at the bottom of the well, and the joke was told one night in a meeting that this guy fell in the well, and everybody came along trying to help him get out. One guy came along from Alcoholics Anonymous. He jumped down in the hole with him. And he said, "Why'd you jump in the well with me? Why didn't you try to pull me out?" He said, "Oh, man, I've been here before. I know the way out. Come on." Come on and follow me. I want my life to be so lived in recovery that I never forget the basics, the back to basics. I'm still the old-fashioned sponsor kind of person. I'm still the old-fashioned person who wears sobriety on a daily basis to the best of my ability. I am still the person that believes in taking a look at my insides, which I never done before I got here. And I still use the 12 steps principles to the best of my ability. Not always. Please don't misunderstand me. I don't come anywhere near doing it 100% right. But I think my efforts and my desire to stay within the circle of recovery and to use what was freely given to me, I believe that it is time for old-timers to back up and use what was given to them. I have read and studied so much about the founders and the beginners and various research as I can obtain it from everywhere. But nothing takes the place of what Alcoholics Anonymous was created to do and what we are doing now. It's a personal It's a spiritual. And it's an amazing thing for a drunk of my type to be respected and to be held with my feet to the fire to live by these things. And I still want you to know that I'm very basically pretty stubborn. Shut up, husband. I heard him thinking. I'm very basically a very stubborn woman, but the one thing that I am not stubborn on is when I get with a newcomer and they used to train you to take yourself back to that place where that newcomer is. As long as you can get back to there and take a view, you got a chance. So I get really bent out of shape when I can't identify with all this double talk and all these double messages that are being given. And as a result of it, I spent a lot of time adjusting and readjusting my thinking. And I have not arrived at Serenity Road where I can stay there all the time? I don't live on Serenity Road. I live on the road of reality of myself and my relationship to God. I am very dependent on observing and participating to the best of my ability in Alcoholics Anonymous. I think it is phenomenal. I think there's nothing that can touch it. I think that we have an obligation, and I think that newcomers need to see the walk and the talk and the action and the results coming up. And the results of adhering to what was given to me in the very beginning has not been so bad, because I came in here as an eighth grade dropout, and in November, I'll have my graduate program finished for a master's. And I'm requesting an honorary doctorate from the university. And a peace of mind I have most of the time, at least 75% of the time. I play around 25% out in the field, kind of wild sometimes. Most people accept me as I am, and I accept most people as they are. I used to hold a full scene on what you were doing wrong. And then I heard Bill Wilson say one time, we absolutely must give others the right to be wrong or it kills us. So I ain't running to the graveyard. I want to experience a few more days of this way of living, and I'm steadily going to reach for the climax, which is called positive sobriety on exhibit. I want to be counted as one of those that utilize, not analyze, that shared, not dictated, that use and not store it up on a shelf. I want to be counted among the people who were doing the best that they could with what they had. I consider myself a blessed female, and I want to be a blessing to other people as I move around this universe. I am honored. I am grateful to be a part of this session. I don't know how much time I got. I'm going to give you all a break.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Next, we are going to hear from Welland, Ontario. And I asked Gary, what is about you and Alcoholics Anonymous? He says he treats Alcoholics Anonymous like he drank, to be joyous and free. And this time he's doing it without the alcohol. From Welland, Ontario, Gary L. Well, thank you. My name is Gary, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm a grateful member of the 12 Steps to Freedom group, and that meets in Welland, Ontario, which is about 10 minutes from Niagara Falls, Canada. And I just want to comment on this lady who's sitting in the fifth row, the blonde lady. She came up as we were sitting here, and she rushed in, and she said, "Am I in the right room? I want to hear about the humility." And we told her that if it was about humility, we'd all be speaking over in the Alamo Dome tonight. So it wasn't quite, you're in the wrong place. There's nothing about humility here. But what I want to talk about is 12-stepping the old-fashioned way. And up in Canada, we do things different. My friend Charles in Akron, he sent me one of these things. This is what Sister Ignatia used to hand out to people when they left St. Thomas Hospital. They would go in, Dr. Bob would do the 12 steps with them, they would leave, and she would say, "Here, take this, and if you're going to drink again, you bring it back to me first." So that's all we do in Canada, we give these out. If they're going to drink again, bring it back to us, and that's it, we're done. So I'm sitting down. But it's kind of neat, because 12-stepping has been a huge part of my life, and I got to qualify that by saying that almost all of my life, I worked as a professional social worker in various social work agencies. Lastly, being one, the protection field, where I was able to take kids away from people. We have different laws in Canada. We can just go into the home, take the kid, and then prove it in court 5 days later. But most of these homes were homes where alcohol and drugs were a big part of that. And, you know, it was, I kind of thought that I was always able to help people. But in Alcoholics Anonymous, I've learned the true value of helping other people. And the people that I try to help today are the people who have a drinking problem, a drinking problem. And I rarely get into other issues. We have a rock group in Canada. Has anybody ever heard of the Tragically Hip? Yeah, some people have. Okay, they're probably Canada's best rock group. And if you can get a copy of their album, Gordy D, he's in recovery, so they say. I tried to get him to speak at a convention, but his website said, "Sorry, we don't know if Mr. D is involved in any 12-step program." So they sort of denied that he was. But he's got a song called "The Exact Feeling." And in that song, he says, you know, "The tiger's wheeling, it's coming back around, and it's covering some ground." And he's talking about the obsession to drink. And he says, "Bartender, I'd be on my hands and knees and screaming for one more of these, for that exact feeling." And when I try to talk with people who come in through the answering service, I'm real fortunate that I have access to a lot of referrals through my own family doctor, through other people. And I try to get them to talk about what alcohol did to them. Because for me, that obsession almost killed me. When I was drinking, I didn't know I had the obsession because I always had access to booze. I always had access. Never had to do anything to get it illegally much anyway. And so for me, I didn't know I had the obsession. It wasn't until I stopped drinking. I stopped drinking in 1983. I ended up in a psych ward because I tried to kill myself a number of times. Totally depressed. Didn't know why. And so I got through the psych ward and through treatment. And it was only that 5 or 6 month period between January and April of 1984 did I start to understand what the obsession was. I literally built a house in my little room in my house in Font Hill, and that's where I hid. I didn't go to my kids' soccer games. I didn't go out with my wife who's here today. I didn't go anywhere because I knew I was going to drink. If you think about drinking, it hit me probably 20,000 times a day. And I literally didn't dare to go to the plaza because the beer store was there, the liquor store was there, the Legion was there. I couldn't go downtown. I'd be in St. Catharines, which is a small city, and I knew that if I started that car in our Penn Center Plaza, I was going to go to the liquor store, or I was going to go to the pub, or I was going to go somewhere I drink. And I would just leave the key out in my hand, and I would phone Carolyn sometimes. Sometimes I would take, you know, get home any way I could, because I knew if I started that car, I would drink. So I have to make an assumption. When I'm out there trying to help somebody, I assume that they're in the same position I was. And the only thing I, as an alcoholic, can give them is hope. And you said it best, that if I can show them that I got out of this mess, then somehow maybe they can come along with me. My goal isn't to get them to Alcoholics Anonymous initially. My goal is to go sit in a donut shop somewhere
and talk about the obsession to drink and how crazy it is inside of your head and how crazy it is when before you do those steps and get that obsession removed. And it's amazing how, I don't know, people tend to identify with that. And our literature, our stories all talk about, you know, Bill doing his steps, about Dr. Bob doing his steps, except step 9, drank again. Our literature talks about the need to do the steps to remove the obsession. And when I came in, people weren't telling me that. In 1984, I came in, and people wanted me to join a group. And people wanted me to get active, and people wanted me to get a sponsor. And I would say, but I want to drink. I want to leave the meeting. I want to go drink. And they would say, no, get a sponsor. And I didn't know why that would work. They would say, do it one day at a time. And I would go home, and I'd literally lock myself away, knowing that if I went out of there, I would drink again. And finally, after about 3 months in Alcoholics Anonymous, one of our old-timers, Leonard, told me, he said, you know, Gary, some people take that big book home. And they do what's in there. And I had no idea what he was talking about because that's the first time I had ever heard about the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Nobody at the meeting I was going to in Fenwick, Ontario, was talking about the big book and doing the steps. They were talking about getting active and they were doing stuff like that, but not doing the steps. And I still wanted to drink. And my wife and I didn't go anywhere. And we didn't go to weddings and we didn't go anywhere because I knew I was going to drink. And I didn't dare to go to the soccer pitch because the guys I drank with were there. And I didn't dare to go to these places. And so I know what it's like to have the obsession. And it's a horrible, horrible, horrible place to be. And so for me, I try to help people understand the obsession, and I try to help them understand that exact feeling, what the alcohol is doing to them. And it's neat because, you know, I belong to a group called 12 Steps to Freedom. And I can only identify with that by saying that it's what gave me the freedom. It's what gave me the freedom to be here today, to go anywhere, to go to my daughter's wedding, to go to places, to play slow pitch again, to go golfing again, to do all these things again. It's that freedom that I got, I guess, initially from the steps that allowed me to go back to work. Within 4 months, and I didn't have a sponsor, I would go over to our local university, I would lock myself in a little cubicle with the big book, a dictionary, And I would just sit in there, trying to figure out all this mess and how this was ever going to help me be able to go to my kid's soccer game. Because that's all I really wanted to do. I wanted to be able to go into my own city of Welland and not just go crazy inside of your head wanting to drink. And that's all I wanted out of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's all I ever came for. And I have to make the assumption that when we go on 12-step calls, we have an answering service. And my friend Ivan's here today. And over the years, there's been about 4 of us for the last 20 years, I guess, on the answering service for the guys anyway. And it's an awesome way for me to stay sober is by seeing other people coming in. And I'm sometimes I get confused as to whether I'm doing it for them or whether I'm doing it for me. In the end, I think I'm doing it for me. Then sometimes I think I'm doing it for them. But in the end of it all, It's given me, as they say in Alcoholics Anonymous, day after day, it's given me back my life. Because I used to sit on the, if you've ever been to Niagara Falls, when you come over those little bridges, there's a little brick wall that runs for about 10 miles all along that Niagara Falls area before you get to the river. And I used to come back across from Niagara Falls, New York, and I would climb over that wall, and I'd sit there with a bag of dope and some pills and some booze, And really just want to end it all, but not having a clue as to why. And I was a social worker, and I should have understood this stuff, but I didn't. I did not know the power of alcohol. I just simply did not know the power of alcohol at that time. And when I found out the power of alcohol about 7 or 8 months into recovery, it just totally amazed me. It just totally amazed me. And today, when I'm sitting across from somebody at a meeting, a newcomer at a meeting, or somebody in a donut shop, And you can look into their eyes and see that they don't understand. They don't understand the power of alcohol. They think it's their wife. They think it's their job. They think it's the economy. They think it's the bills. They think it's the DWIs. They think it's this. And they don't understand the power of alcohol. And they don't understand really how that obsession is so deeply embedded in them like it was in me. It took a long time to get out of there. And once I've been fortunate in staying in touch with people, but when people understand that they have the obsession, and once they understand that the 12 steps removes it, it is the greatest feeling in the world to see their that little light come on in their eyes and that little light come on and say, hey, in order for me to be happy, joyous, and free, all I have to do is do the steps, and that removes the obsession. Maybe not the desire, maybe not the craving, maybe not the want, maybe not the need, but it removes the obsession. And with that becomes the peace of mind. And when I was introduced, it said I treat AA the same way I did drinking. I absolutely insist upon having fun. It's awesome. We partied when I was drinking. And in recovery, my wife and I go to every convention, every dance that's within, you know, a couple of hundred miles of Niagara Falls. We try to be active in all the roundups. We try to do all the stuff that allows us to live the same lifestyle, I guess, without the booze. And I think you put it best. We come down here on Tuesday, and it was a hoot. We were down swimming in the waves in that hurricane in Corpus Christi 2 days ago. We were the ones that you saw on the TV cameras saying, who are these idiots out here swimming in the middle of the thing? Well, some of us are here this whole day. We were the idiots that were swimming. But that's what, you know, that's what AA has done for me. It's a great way to live. And that hope is there because it came to me. When Leonard said that the answer's in the big book, I know that then I got the hope. And I know I drove my wife crazy that next 2 or 3 months. She'd be upstairs in bed or sleep. I'd run up and I'd pull up with the big book and I'd say, look, this is it. Look at this. Read this. Yeah, I'll read it tomorrow. But I got so excited. I got so excited about the big book that it was just amazing. And so my goal, I think, I don't know whether we're supposed to have goals when they're doing 12-step work or not, but I do. And my goal is to help that person decide whether they're an alcoholic of the type we are, who has the obsession to drink, and maybe the 12 steps can be the answer. If they decide not to go on and do with it, that's entirely up to them. But if they decide to, then that's when I like to get involved, and I've been real lucky to be able to do some 12-step study groups and things like that and one-on-ones, and it's just a great way of life. But there's no better phone call. Sometimes we'll be going out, and the phone rings, and you see that central communications, that's our answer, pop up in the thing. And you just go, yes, it's great. Because you know that at some point in that next hour or so, you're going to be directly able to help somebody maybe stay sober one day at a time. And that's really what we're all about. Our primary purpose is to carry the message to the alcoholic who still suffers. And sometimes in AA, when I hang out with a bunch of people who are all sober 20, 15, 17 years, and sometimes we forget just how important it is to find that active alcoholic, that still drinking alcoholic on the other side of the line. And when I look down and I see central communications, I go, yes, it's great, because people are reaching out. And what I try to do with people is give them a good AA experience. I talk to them about 13 stepping. I talk to them about who to look out for. I have no problem mentioning names in AA. I say, you stay away from that person, and you stay away from that person. Because if you're here to get sober, don't don't go near them. Just don't go near them, because they're not here to get the obsession removed. I know it's not right. I know it's not right. But I do it anyway, because I value their sobriety over how that person's going to view me. They may talk about me at the next meeting and say, who's he to think he can say that? But to me, the sobriety of people, I worked mainly in my job over those 25, 30 years that I was with that social agency. I worked with young mothers who had children and young mothers who were out on the street in Niagara Falls and Ontario there. And so when young women come into AA with their kids sometimes in tow and they need the help, the last thing that they need is somebody trying to hustle them. And I've been criticized for mentioning names, but I tell them right up front, if you go near that person and you lose your kids because of him, I will certainly go to court and say, we warned you. I mean, that's not AA, but that's my own personal value. That's my own personal value, and it's something that I have to do. And so 12-stepping is for me what it's all about, and it's been a real privilege to be here. This is certainly the highlight of my life. I know that my name was drawn randomly out of a hat, but the point is that I got here. Actually, I'll tell you, we got a bunch of people in. How much time do I have? Okay. We have a bunch of people who, we've all heard that in service, 5% of the people do all, 100% of the work for that 5 to 7%. And in our district, we had some people who were long-timers, and they never got involved in service. And I happened to do this little thing in service. I'm more of a service person than I am a 12-step person. And I did this little thing on pie plates, and this is the steps, this is the traditions, and these are the concepts. And it has to do with our ego going down and getting smaller and smaller as we stay in service. And my friend Janice said, you should go to the convention in San Antonio and do that. And that's what I was supposed to do. I'm not even supposed to be in this room. I'm like her. I'm in the wrong room, maybe. But anyway, I'm just glad to be here because for me, 12-stepping is a way of life. It's a way of life and just simply the best way of life I've ever experienced. And with that, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Chuck, Virginia, Gary, and I would just close with a couple of thoughts on 12-stepping. For those of you who are involved in PCP and talking to non-alcoholic groups, there's a host of us, there are a number of us who came in to Alcoholics Anonymous in 1951, an alcoholic talked to a group of businessmen and told about the story of his recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous. And there's a man sitting in the audience who was so impressed with his sincerity, told about his recovery, his humility, his story of his recovery, that he went back to his place of business looking for an alcoholic to help. And when he found one, he fired me and sent me to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I have to tell you that the great thing that whenever, now, if I have an opportunity, never, ever, hopefully the level of press, radio and film, etc., as it says in our tradition, but have the opportunity to share my recovery with those around me. And through the years, I've had an opportunity. People would call me and say, "Ralph, are you still involved in AA?" They had heard it through the grapevine, or I talked to them about it very, very openly and freely. And I said, "Yes, I am." And they said, "Listen, I've got a guy, the president of our company, or somebody. I got a guy, and I would know them." And he said, "Would you mind calling them?" I said, "Well, of course." Now, I have to remember, because when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, they had said the alcoholic had to make the phone call. Well, so when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was 24 years old. And they said anybody under 40 hasn't suffered enough. Anybody over 60 is over the hill. Either way, I'd have been out of luck then and now. And you got to think about it. And but now, remembering that when Ebby talked to Bill, Bill didn't call him, talk to him. He didn't make the call. Dr. Bob didn't make the call. Henrietta Seiberling made the call. And somebody calls me and they said, "John, has a problem." And I said, "Sometimes I've even heard about it." And I have no compunction whatsoever. And this is the old-fashioned 12-step call, like they, my view, which is not necessarily correct, my opinion about what I heard. And I would call and say, "John, this is Ralph. I understand there's an outside chance you may have a problem with alcohol." But I've probably done this 10 or 15 times, and 100% of them always said, "Who told you that?" And I said, "What difference does it make?" And I've been in AA, and I'm wondering if there is, but maybe you and I could talk about this. And that's sort of my awareness of the old-fashioned 12-step call, getting the process started, and then asking if there's a chance that you would like to go to a meeting with me. And maybe half of the time, I don't know, a third of the time, say, "Sure, yeah, okay." And then they stand me up two or three times. And then, of course, you know the drill. And sometimes it works out. And some of them say, no, I don't have a problem with alcohol, Ralph. But if I ever decide that I do, I'll know who to call. And some call and some don't. And that's the end of that. But I know one thing. And I'm so engrossed and so involved. It's not the epicenter of my life. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, my sponsors told me three things. He says, when you come to Alcoholics Anonymous, make Alcoholics Anonymous program the most important single thing in your life, more important than anything, your family, your job, your bowling, your curly. Doesn't make any difference. Make Alcoholics Anonymous the most important single thing in your life. And then it's anticipated that after you stay sober for a while, you return to normalcy. And in church and family and job and hobbies, other things come back and there's a balance in your life. But from that day forward, one day at a time, the most important single thing in your life is your sobriety. I said, I kind of got that, and so I was trying to work on that. But after you stay sober for a while, as many of us have in this room, you sit around for a while and you get to suck it on your own exhaust pipe. Humming a few bars of how great thou art. And the only thing that I've found that's worth a hoot after these years of sobriety and Alcoholics Anonymous is finding some way to carry the message to the alcoholic who still suffers. And what an incredible, because the pay value, as Chuck said, Virginia said, and Gary said, the pay value is what accrues to me. Once you focus on that new alcoholic, you take the emphasis off your own convulsive ego. And life becomes so much more beautiful. Thank you for investing a part of your convention in us and the opportunity to be with you. And we'll stand and close with the Lord's Prayer for those of you who would like to.